Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Mr. Lego, and I have served as the counsel for the estate in the case below before the estate was dismissed. I assume I can dispense with a concise statement of the case because we've basically heard it from Mr. Murray. I'm reminded of your statement that I must speak into closer to the microphone. I hope this is okay. Audible. What happened in the estate case is shortly before trial, there was a motion to dismiss for lack of subject matter jurisdiction, and that motion was granted. The motion also included a request for attorney's fees for a frivolous claim, and that was denied by the court's ruling orally. And then there was a resubmission after the verdict came in and the judgment was entered against Mr. Lego. There was a motion filed. We call it the motion for renewed motion for sanctions, that was denied by the court in what we call the sanctions denial order.
Mr. Lego, was your motion to dismiss the claim against the estate filed just on the eve of trial?
Yes.
And that was the first time you made that motion, right?
That is correct.
And the motion was based on 1512-104, the statute that says an estate can't be sued absent a probate. Right? Or I'm absent a personal representative being appointed.
I think essentially that is so.
When did you discover? When did you, as a lawyer for the estate, discover the potential applicability of 1512-104?
Probably a year or so before the trial.
And why didn't you make the motion then, and why did you let the case drag on against the estate for that time?
As indicated in the brief, Your Honor, that's a good question. It was decided for tactical reasons that it would not be judicious at that point to assert that claim, assuming it's going to be successful, or rather that motion, that the claim lacks subject matter jurisdiction, because what had occurred in the case, I mean, it's a companion case. The case against the estate is parallels a case against me individually on a sole claim of breach of implied contract in fact. And what they had originally done, Your Honor, in the complaint was seek relief against Mr. Lego personally on the family expense doctrine. But then when they amended their complaint after a motion to dismiss was filed by the estate and by Mr. Lego, they excluded or dropped that particular claim.
And left it just primarily a claim against the estate, right? The amended complaint was primarily against the estate and you as the personal representative of the estate, right?
The amended complaint was against both the estate and Mr. Lego.
As the personal representative?
By dropping the family expense doctrine.
Right.
And since that left only one claim, and the claim against Mr. Lego for an implied contract.
So to me, it would have been logical to move to dismiss that case under 1512-104 as soon as you discovered that's the applicability of that statute. But I don't understand why you didn't do that other than to, for some reason, to let the case drag on. I didn't understand.
With utmost respect, Judge Richman, it was not to just let the case drag on. First of all, in view of the rulings that we had encountered in the case, there was not great confidence or optimism that challenge to the subject matter jurisdiction would be, in fact, successful. But as I say, the idea was, had we done it, we would have flagged the fact that there would be no claim against me left, arguably, because I was not a patient in the hospital. I'm Mr. Lego. I was not somebody who had acted in any capacity other than as an attorney in fact, a representative, attorney at law, representing the estate and my wife's interest. They had no claim left, and they would have then added the family expense doctrine claim back in, and they then would have had, by amendment, appropriate amendment if they did, and they never did. It only came up until, trial, when there was an effort to incorporate or introduce instructions on that, which we then resisted.
So let me just summarize what I think you just said. You're, the defendants in this case got a tactical advantage by not moving to dismiss the claim against the estate because you were hopeful that this, maybe the statute of limitations would run. You wouldn't be added back in as an individual, and the claim against the estate would be dropped later on when you made that motion. That's basically what you're thinking, right?
I think that's a fair statement, Your Honor.
Okay. Given that, why in the world should the hospital pay your attorney's fees for obtaining that tactical advantage?
Because they ran that risk by not doing their diligence and not checking the law and bringing a claim against a phantom target, a non-existent entity. And in doing that, they ran the risk that at some point someone would claim that they should be liable for the attorney fees attributable to the defense of that particular claim.
Don't you think the statute puts some duty on the attorney to tell his opposing party that your claim is invalid? I mean, it has an implication in the statute, the attorney's fee statute. You've got to give them some kind of notice that this claim is invalid. Drop it, or I'm going to seek attorney's fees.
That was a matter of opinion. It was our opinion that it was invalid.
But you never gave them any notice that it was invalid till you made the motion, right? Just before trial.
That is correct.
Mr. Lego, if I understand your position, you're saying that while you recognized that 1512-104 applied or apparently applied in this case with respect to the estate, that on the other hand, Porter Hospital should have recognized it like 3 years before you recognized it. Is that correct?
They're the ones that brought the, that, Your Honor, Judge Taubman, permit me to say this. They are the ones that brought the claim. They're the ones who did not investigate, analyze the law, familiarize themselves with what needed to be done in order to competently, effectively bring a claim against the estate. They proceeded against a non-existent entity. And our awareness of that, our focus on that, came somewhat belatedly because we didn't know, up to our elbows in dealing with the remainder of the case.
But it seems to me that what you're suggesting is that what was not immediately apparent to you should have been immediately apparent to the attorneys for Porter Hospital.
The difference was twofold, Your Honor. One, they had a duty to investigate. They had a Rule 11 responsibility to bring this action in good faith and represent to the court by signing the pleadings that they had a good faith basis to do so, that they had done their diligence and there's a viable basis. We had no such duty. Moreover, the cases that we've cited in our brief indicate that we had no duty to assert, with all deference to Judge Richman's comments, which make a lot of sense. But we had no duty under the case authorities that we observed and studied and analyzed when we focused on the matter. We had no duty to assert that. Then we could assert it later, and there were tactical reasons in the management of the case as a lawyer trying to manage the matter that it seemed sensible for us not to assert that until later. And so that was a judgment call.
Yes, I understand your explanation about the strategy decision, but I'm not asking you about that, but because I'm focusing on the standard for your claim for attorney's fees, which is a frivolous and groundless action. And it seems from the Porter Hospital brief that they had at least an arguable basis for their position based upon statements that you had made that you were the representative of the estate, even if they were arguably wrong in not investigating the impetus of 1512-104.
May I respond, Judge Taubman, to
please
that?
Please do, yes.
Yeah. I think that those arguments are invalid and fallacious on two grounds. First of all, the authorities that we've cited in our reply brief abundantly establish that there is, no duty to bring the challenge, the motion on against subject matter jurisdiction until we did. And moreover, you cannot consent as a matter of law to or admit subject matter jurisdiction, or more aptly stated, you can't establish or confer upon a court that does not have subject matter jurisdiction, such jurisdiction by admitting it or consenting to it. And that's what they, in fact, have suggested. By doing, submitting documents and signing things, we essentially have admitted or consented to. The second problem they have is they're suggesting that by acting as a personal representative, or stating we did, and that's our color, our characterization, my response and deposition to their question about what, you know, what were you the personal representative? Well, I surely was, in an informal sense. They missed the difference between a de jure status of a real, duly constituted, law-complying personal representative, and someone who steps in defense of a bogus claim, if you will, a claim against a phantom target, a non-existent target, and steps up and says, in this system, where if you don't respond to a claim, defaults can be entered against you, we're saying that the interests of my wife and the decedent after her death prompted us to take the initiative to come in, and we thought, frankly, the matter would be disposed of on the statute of limitations. And that's another reason why there was no, what's the word, disposition to be focused on some other such defenses as the subject matter jurisdiction. And so I hope that answers the question. So it was twofold. They had no basis whatsoever to assume, understand, or perceive or discern that I was a personal representative. There was no entity that I could be such a representative of. I was just acting informally, acting as a person trying to step up, just like a person who would act before if you were complying with probate provisions with respect to trying to submit a claim. Somebody has to go in before a personal representative is appointed and act. And in doing so, you're not acting as a personal representative de jure, then you're acting in an informal capacity. And as we said in the brief, this happens all the time. It's a pragmatic aspect of case management.
Mr. Lego, you've just given us about 2 minutes of a qualification as to why you were and maybe were not a personal representative. But in the answer to the complaint, you admitted that you were the personal representative, and you did so unequivocally without qualification. Don't you think you had an obligation under Rule 11 to indicate any qualification to that allegation?
In context, I have already addressed the matter. I had been deposed. There was only one deposition taken in the case, and that was a deposition of me. And I was asked that very question by counsel for the plaintiff. And it was a question that addressed the very matter you talked about other prior responses and indicating that I was acting as a personal representative. And that's nomenclature. That's a denomination, that's a color or status or characterization that I perceive was appropriate. And I said in response to, and it's quoted in their brief, that I was acting informally. They asked if any, I indicated I had not been formally appointed. I was not duly constituted. I was acting informally. De facto, I use that word. And if I may, the definitions of de facto and de jure are quite contrasting. In their Black's Law Dictionary, de jure means you fully complied with the applicable law. You're duly constituted as a matter of law. De facto is just the opposite. You're not duly constituted as a matter of law. You have some status or standing or purport or profess to have some standing on an informal, non-de jure basis. And that was our perception, that was our belief, and that was what we communicated to the plaintiff in response to questions at my deposition.
Were you ever asked to produce letters of appointment as a personal representative by the by the plaintiff?
Never.
And of course there were none, right?
No.
There had never been a probate of this estate?
There was no probate, Your Honor, and there was no probate undertaken timely by the plaintiff. The plaintiff could have brought timely in the Wright County, which would have been Arapahoe County, where my wife died. That's the place where the proceeding should have been brought. A personal representative de jure properly appointed, a claim asserted, and done so within 1 year. They could have done all that. That's what I was alluding to earlier, but in somewhat generally. They didn't do that. And so when we became aware of that, we thought we had a very responsible and cogent argument to challenge the jurisdiction, subject matter jurisdiction of the court. Then there was a question of when to do it.
Mr. Lego, I know your time's up, but I have one follow-up question to that.
I beg your pardon.
No, that's all right. You say that the claim would have been properly brought in a different county. But again, in your answer to the amended complaint, you admitted that venue was proper in Denver County. Now, that wouldn't be the case if there had been no personal representative appointed. But you admitted it nonetheless. Don't you think you were misleading the hospital?
No, at the time we weren't. I don't think we were misleading anybody. First of all, that was our impression at the time, that venue was proper. And whether we admit it or we opine that or we have an impression that it is, doesn't make it so. The venue, in fact, was improper as a matter of law. They should have known that, and we didn't have a duty to inquire about that at that time. And we answered in good faith. At that time, we thought it was. We thought it was.
Thank you, Mr. Lego.
Thank you.
Good morning. Again, for the record, I'm Tracy Van Pelt, representing Porter Hospital. The trial court's decision on the estate's claim for fees needs to be reviewed for an abuse of discretion standard. And I submit the record is clear. The trial court did not abuse its discretion. There's ample support for the trial court's decision to not award fees. As a number of judges pointed out during Mr. Lego's oral argument, Mr. Lego admitted in the answer to the complaint he was the personal representative to the estate. Did not qualify that in any way, shape, or form. He admitted that venue was proper in Denver County on behalf of the estate and him individually. There's always a claim for joint and several liability for Mr. Lego and the estate. So the idea that somehow the family expense doctrine, which is the legal authority for a joint and several liability claim, abrogated or was a tactical reason for not raising this issue simply doesn't hold up upon a review of the pleadings. Mr. Lego testified under oath in written discovery. He was the personal representative of the estate.
I'm confused about what he just said. Mm-hmm. If, once the family expense doctrine claim was dropped, what was the basis for suing Mr. Lego just as a personal representative?
No, as Mr. Lego was sued individually and the estate was sued, and there was always a claim for joint and several liability on implied contract for Mr. Lego and the estate. What the court found and what we submitted at the time of trial was the family expense doctrine is not a separate claim. It's the legal basis for a joint and several liability claim. And the joint and several liability claim has been in the complaint and the amended complaint and remained in the amended complaint. And he responded to that allegation both individually and on behalf of the estate. So the amended complaint expressly claims joint and several liability between Mr. Lego individually and the estate. And the family expense doctrine, as well as the doctrine of necessaries, which is the common law equivalent, was the legal support for the claim of joint and several liability.
Added him as a personal representative, as a defendant, as a personal representative on the amended complaint based on the testimony that he had given in his deposition that he was a personal representative?
No. Mr. Lego is confused about the timing of that. Maybe okay. I can clarify. There was a complaint filed against Mr. Lego individually and the estate. In response to that complaint, Mr. Lego was representing himself pro se and was representing the estate. He filed a motion to dismiss. We filed an amended complaint naming Mr. Lego individually and the estate in the amended complaint and asserted a claim for joint and several liability.
You named him as the personal representative of the estate in the amended complaint.
That's
that was
correct.
The first time you did that. And that's what he answered affirmatively to.
That's correct. He admitted in the answer to the amended complaint that he was the personal representative of the estate of Bernadette Lego and that venue was proper in Denver District Court.
Afterwards, he gave a deposition in which he claims he qualified that.
Yeah, and let me back up because there's one additional piece of information because we served written discovery on Mr. Lego and the estate before he was deposed. And we asked him to admit he was the personal representative of the estate of Bernadette Lego, and his answer was an unqualified admission in our written discovery. Yes, and then we took his deposition and asked him, you are the personal representative of the estate of Bernadette Lego, and he said, yes. We asked if he'd been appointed. He said, no, I'm acting as the personal representative of the estate for the purposes of this lawsuit. In addition, throughout the underlying proceedings, the estate affirmatively sought intervention and relief from the court, both defensively and affirmatively, with respect to claims against the estate. And under the totality of the circumstances, the trial court assessed all of this, looked at the changes in the statute regarding personal representatives, and found the claim was not frivolous and denied the award of attorney's fees.
Ms. Van Pelt, I think the thrust of Mr. Lego's argument is that regardless of what he said or did, that Porter Hospital had an obligation to have researched 1512-104 and to have pursued a claim against the estate or established formal estate proceedings. What is your response to that?
Given the circumstances of this case where Mr. Lego admitted to being the personal representative of the estate, I don't think Porter was on notice to do that, and that it was not frivolous for Porter to continue, given Mr. Lego's actions, to pursue a claim against the estate. If he had never raised that issue and judgment had been entered against the estate, it may be a valid judgment against the estate. I mean, Mr. Lego did not in any way alert Porter to the fact that he was not a, as he puts it, de jure, personal representative of the estate, and under the circumstances, it was appropriate for Porter to proceed. Having no formal probate having been opened for the estate is a matter that Porter could have investigated, but the issue before the court is, was it an abuse of discretion for the trial court to not award attorney's fees under the circumstances of this case? And I submit it wasn't. A couple of other points to raise, one of the arguments raised with the trial court is that the personal representative can be, there is authority from other jurisdictions that a de facto personal representative who takes actions on behalf of the estate can be named. And while the court recognized there wasn't any case law in Colorado on that point, it certainly supports the claim that this was not a frivolous claim brought by Porter, and it was not abuse of discretion to deny the request for attorney's fees. So in sum, I think this is a simple issue, given the standard of review for the court and Mr. Lego's conduct and the totality of the circumstances which the trial court investigated, there was simply no abuse of discretion here.
Any of the attorney's fees awarded against Mr. Lego to your client based on this conduct involving the delay in filing the motion to dismiss the estate?
Were the attorney's fees awarded in favor of Porter based upon Mr. Lego's delay?
Conduct and delaying?
No. The attorney's fee award in favor of Porter was based upon Mr. Lego's conduct throughout the 4 years of litigation. As I said in the companion case, this was a very simple case, a simple claim. The court found that Mr. Lego, through discovery abuses and repeated filings of the same motions over and over and over, greatly, greatly increased the expense. This case could have been tried in a day. It took 4 days.
It sounds like he increased the expense by having you pursue the estate when there was no claim against the estate from the day you filed it, from the day he discovered it. But you don't think the judge awarded fees to your client for that?
I don't think so. The reason being that I don't think the court took the position that it was parsed out the estate issue from Mr. Lego's issue.
The problem is that we don't have any findings by the court that indicate how she came up with that $150,000 in attorney's fees, except for that very short order, do we?
The court's order is short. I will tell you the submission that was provided by Porter has a very detailed affidavit, billing records, and that kind of information in support of the award, and Mr. Lego did not ask for a hearing.
To reopen the other case?
Yes.
Did you back out the fees that related to, say, defending the claims against, I mean, pursuing the claims against the estate or defending against his motion to dismiss? Did you deduct those fees?
No.
So they're included in the
yes.
fees that were awarded? So
yes.
They are included.
Okay. If the panel doesn't have any further questions, I think I've addressed the issues that Porter needs to address on the abuse of discretion standard. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. This case will also stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course. That ends the docket for this morning.